You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Today on Barca Talk, Mounir is out, Neymar keeps calling, and Ter Stegen is named to UEFA Fans Team of the Year. We finally announced the Barca Talk Awards for the year. Barca B is begging the question as to what their purpose is for the club, and there's shocking news from the women's team. Also, the first team lost to Levante in the Copa del Rey and defeated Eibar in La Liga. Hey everybody, welcome to Barca Talk. I'm Brian Henderson, coming to you from snowy Buffalo, New York, and joining me from Madrid, Spain, as always, is Gabriel Quiroga.
Brian, my Barca brother from another mother. What is going on? How are we doing this weekend?
We are doing very well this weekend. You know, I got to tell you, things have been happening as far as getting ready for the wedding and the trip to San Francisco. That's in 1 week. We're going there next weekend, and Megan is actually leaving on this Tuesday to do a bunch of stuff in town ahead of it, and then I'm leaving on Friday. I'll meet up with her for the weekend, and we're getting all of our things squared away. I spent my Friday afternoon transcribing Bach music because we got a string trio to play during the procession, and you know, we're both musicians, so we're really picky about the music that they play. So I decided she wants to walk down the aisle to that Death Cab for Cutie song, I Will Follow You Into the Dark. You know that one?
I do.
Yeah, so she's going to walk down the aisle to that. But prior to that, and you know, when everyone else is walking down the procession, we hadn't decided on music for that, and we hadn't decided on the exit, you know, once we're done and we're walking back. We hadn't decided on what to do for that. And, of course, we don't want to do any of the standard wedding march music. We don't want to do the Here Comes the Bride thing, mm-hmm. which, for anyone who's curious, is actually... it's actually wedding music from an opera by Richard Wagner called Lohengrin, just so you know. And then the standard exit music is, I forget exactly what it is, but I know it's by Mendelssohn. And I was like, no, I want Bach. I want Bach all over the place because he's my man. He's the guy. Nice. So I was sort of taking some of his keyboard music and transcribing it for string trio last night. We sent it out to the players, and so hopefully they'll be on top of that. That's exciting. Everything is pretty much squared away, so I'm very pleased with
nice.
Yeah, very pleased. And mostly I have to say, like, she doesn't listen to the show, but I have to give a shout out to my wife Megan for doing most of the planning. All I did was I lined up the DJ, I'm in charge of table assignments, and I did that music thing, and I think that's pretty much all I did.
That's good. Good job.
So, good job to Megan.
Yeah, well, yes. Good job to Megan for planning, but also, you know, just execute your chores, your tasks.
Yes,
you know?
I did my thing. How are you? What's going on in Madrid?
I'm doing all right. You know, the weather, like we talked about on the Thursday show, is we're having a polar weather here, as they call it here. It is cold. It is, you know, about 0-3 degrees Celsius, so it is pretty chilly. But other than that, I'm just relaxing this weekend. I'm going to be watching, after we record, I'm going to be watching the Manchester United-Tottenham match. And then after that, I'm just going to hang out here at the house and watch some NFL too, just kind of chill out this weekend, because the last couple of weeks for Christmas here in Spain, been doing a lot of eating and drinking. So I'm just going to take it easy this weekend and, of course, watch the Barca game tomorrow at home. So that's pretty much it. Just really kind of relaxing, catching up on some things around the house, and nothing too exciting this weekend.
That's good, you know, because the holidays, yeah, you do a lot of eating, a lot of drinking, a lot of socializing, and you know, it can be a little bit much. So I get it. It's good to just decompress a little bit after the holidays, have some you time.
Exactly. My friends, my old roommates, when I used to live in Phoenix, they would always make fun of me that on Sundays, I would always ask for alone time. They would always go to the movies together and they're like, do you want to go? And I said, no, I'm going to just stay in because it was like my one chance to be alone at the house, you know? And they're like, oh, it's Gabriel's alone Sunday alone time. And I'm like, yes, leave, you know? And they would always go to the movies together.
Yeah, yes, so, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And so I've kind of carried that tradition. Now that I live by myself, I don't have to worry about that as much, but I do like to have the occasional Gabriel alone time weekend.
Well, so, yeah, sure. Because you live so much of your life outside, you know, meeting up with friends, and you're living that Madrid lifestyle. You still need some alone time, even though you do live alone.
Exactly. And on top of that, I want to watch a little bit of the NFL playoffs. And especially since it is cold, you know, like we talked about that, obviously it's not as cold here as it is in Buffalo, but since you are always walking outside more here, it feels colder than it really is. So I'm just going to stay in where I got heat. And I'm just going to watch some NFL football, maybe make some nachos later and just relax.
Yeah. Walking outside right now in Buffalo it's a whole production. You got to really prepare if you're going to take a walk any longer than, I don't know, 100 yards.
Yeah.
I got my hat. I got my gloves. I got my long underwear. I got everything. Okay. I'm going to the coffee shop.
It reminds me of a Christmas story when the youngest one gets wrapped up, right? You got to do the thermos, the clothes, the scarf, the whole thing. Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, and it's a real problem for sidewalk traffic because no one can put their arms down.
Nice. I like that. Yeah. Starfish is everywhere.
Yeah. Well, before we get into Barcelona news, I got to talk to our listeners for just a second because, guys, Valentine, or should I say, as Pep Guardiola would say, guys. Valentine's Day is right around the corner, so how about giving your wife or girlfriend something totally different, something romantic, and I'm talking about a luxury gift service called Enclosed that delivers designer lingerie to the special woman in your life month after month. Enclosed is like beer of the month, but instead of beer, she gets ultra high-end lingerie. And we've been checking out the site, and this is seriously high-end stuff, what we at Barca Talk would call primo lingerie. Enclosed was designed specifically to help you guys find gifts for the special women in your lives, and I'm not talking about your mother. Enclosed is all about helping you make her happy, and it's effortless for you. Every month, Enclosed sends your wife or girlfriend a custom-curated lingerie gift selected just for her, and they back up the gift with a 100% size guarantee so you never have to worry about fit. Come on and join more than 30,000 couples that love Enclosed, and we'll give you a little gift. Right now, you can get $35 off your Enclosed gift. Just go to enclosedlingerie.com, that's E-N-C-L-O-S-E-D, lingerie.com, and enter the coupon code BARCATALK at checkout to get $35 off any Enclosed multi-month gift. So that code is BARCATALK, all one word, and don't even try to use the Cedilla, just a normal letter C in Barca, to get $35 off any multi-month gift. Give your wife or girlfriend something that reflects and deepens the connection between the two of you. That's enclosedlingerie.com with the code BARCATALK for $35 off the best gift ever. All right, let's get into some news. You were curating all of the news for this week, and I got to say, you did a bang-up job. So what's our first item today, Gabriel?
Well, our first thing is our boy Munir Seva. He's going to Sevilla. You know, it's official. It happened over the last couple of days, but it is official. You know, like we talked about earlier this week about the transfer possibility of Munir not getting playing time as well. And Sevilla did purchase him. They did pay Barcelona the transfer fee of more than €1 million. So Munir is off to Sevilla. And I think it's a good move for him personally, because I think obviously he's going to get more playing time. And also, I think one of the strategies why he did not renew with Barcelona is because he knew wherever he was going to go, he was able to sign a contract extension with that club. And so I believe when I was watching the news today, he did sign a 3 or 4 year contract extension with Sevilla. So Sevilla are really happy to have him because now they have better depth at the forward position. And Munir is going to get definitely more playing time now going forward.
Yeah, it seems like he's going to get a lot more playing time. If nothing else, you know, he'll come in to substitute. Sevilla is still in the Copa del Rey for sure. And they're still in Europe, I think, right?
Yeah, that is correct.
So, yeah, he's going to have minutes. And it just seems like Machin he would tend to use Munir more. His strategy, his tactics use a player like Mooney or more. So I think this is going to be a good move for everyone. This is a good situation, right? It's a win-win. Mounir's happy. He's going to be playing more. And Sevilla's a fun attacking team at times, so he's going to have a lot of action. Barcelona, you know, they've unloaded a player who, try as they might, you know, they just hasn't landed for Barcelona. So we're rid of a player that we're not really using. We free up some space, free up some wage bill. It's a win-win all around.
Yeah, it is a win-win. And especially we were able to get something for him, you know, because during the last, I think the last 5 days or so, because Mounir did not want to renew with Barcelona, Valverde basically told him that he was not going to be called up going further. So I think it all just came, you know, all the stars aligned. And, you know my feelings on Mounir. I just think he's not good enough to be a starter for Barcelona. But I think for a team like Sevilla, I think it's a good fit for him. Plus, he won't have the pressure of being like a La Masia player that has to perform at a high level. I think going to Sevilla, where it's a little bit more relaxed, you know, they are in these competitions of Copa del Rey and Champions League, but it's not the same type of pressure as it is in Barcelona. So I think it'll be a good fit for him, and we'll see what his goal output is at the end of the season.
Yeah, and what did you say? They paid, what, $1 million for him?
Yeah, they paid $1 million for his services.
See, that's funny to me because, like, to Sevilla, $1 million is... it's not a ton of money, but it's, you know, you feel it. Meanwhile, Barcelona, yeah. I feel like they have a, you know, take $1 million, leave $1 million tray right at the front of the offices, you know.
So. I love it. Take $1 million, give $1 million.
Yeah, whatever, you know, just spread it around.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, especially with a club like Sevilla, especially, you know, they don't have the amount of depth that Barcelona has. So this is going to help them with the competitions that they're in. And like I said, Mounir is a good player. He just, it's one of those things. He just needs more playing time. You know, we saw what he could do in Alaves. He did have some good highlights, some good plays, and scored some goals. But he's just not going to find that playing time in Barcelona. There's just too many superstars ahead of him.
Yeah. So we have one outgoing, and there's apparently a lot more heat around a potential incoming. So what's the next item we have up?
Yeah, so El Mundo came out with this piece that Neymar is desperate to come back. And I just think it's funny because, you know, he came here. It was kind of a shady deal when he did come here, just with the payment for his father and the club and how that all went down. And, you know, he was here and obviously he had success. We won the Champions League with him. He was a star player. And I still just can't fathom why he wanted to leave, because ultimately he just went for the money. Right? Because basically what's happening here is Neymar and his father have called Barcelona 5 times this season so far to basically try to see if there's an opportunity for him to come back. And basically their reason for it is that Neymar isn't happy with what they're calling the proyecto or the sporting direction of PSG. And as we've talked about, Ligue 1 is a lower tier division of Europe. It's, you know, PSG's usually going to win Ligue 1, even though they were eliminated from the Cope, like their Copa del Rey. They were eliminated this week, but there's just not enough competition. And I think Neymar really misses the camaraderie that he had with the South American players on Barcelona.
Yeah, it seems like PSG, the whole thing of PSG in recent years has been to essentially spend a whole lot of money, because basically PSG is backed by roughly the entire nation of Qatar and all of the money that comes along with it. So they've just been on this project to buy essentially mercenary players to try and win the Champions League. But I don't think they quite understand the idea of creating a sporting culture, creating a good dressing room, and all that sort of stuff. They've gone through different managers. And like you said, Ligue 1 is just, of the top European leagues, it's the bottom. It's the bottom of the top, you know?
Yeah.
Like my friend Connor says, you know, PSG, they're playing oftentimes against clubs that are literally, you know, the players are actual farmers. They farm during the week and they play football on the weekends, you know.
Yeah,
like that's where Ligue 1 is at. So I'm just wondering, because you were mentioning how Neymar and his father have called Barcelona a number of times, are we at the point yet where Neymar is going to be is standing outside of the Camp Nou with the boombox over his head playing Peter Gabriel?
Yeah exactly. In your eyes.
Are we at that point yet?
No, we're not at that point yet. But it's just funny to me because, you know, it's not as Barcelona is not a top four team in the world. You know, there really wasn't more he could do. He was going to be the heir apparent to Messi. That was the whole goal. And like we always talk about, why Brazilians always thrive usually in Barcelona is because the climate of not only the actual physical climate of Barcelona, but also the climate in the locker room. It's just more forgiving. It feels like Brazil to them, you know, and they feel very comfortable. And to me, yeah, obviously Neymar got a huge pay rise, but it wasn't like he was earning nothing before. So, and he also always comes back to Barcelona. There's always pictures of him on social media, on his social media, you know, hanging out with Piqué and Messi and Suarez and so forth. So I just think, you know, they had a unique partnership. He obviously went to PSG for the money, tried to get some more glory, hopefully to win a Ballon d'Or. And that hasn't happened. And now he's kind of, you know, realizing, especially now that he's getting older already, you know, he's realizing that decision was a bad decision. So they're just, you know, you never know if you don't ask, right?
Sure.
So I'm going to ask you, do you want him back?
See, I was just going to ask you the same thing. And I think I was going to wait. I think I wanted you to respond first so that I could condition my response around that.
But,
I'll go first.
Okay.
I don't want him back, but I recognize that having him back would probably mature. He would probably, because maybe he's been such a little bitch lately because he's just unhappy with where he is and you know, how the football is going at his club and what it's like in the dressing room. Maybe he's just responding to his environment, and maybe if he were back at Barcelona, it would be a better environment for him. And he would be a little bit more endearing to me. Obviously, his ability is great, right? So if I were just looking at his talent and what he could bring to the team, I would absolutely want him back. But of course, you got to take into account all of those other factors. So if you give him the benefit of the doubt and say, if we bring him back here, he'll be more comfortable, he'll be happier. If we welcome him with open arms, he will thrive. If we take that stance on it, I could understand bringing him back. But I have to say, like, right now I feel like I've been burned, and I don't want to get back together with him.
I mean, I basically, you know, have the same sentiment, because yes, he's a world-class player, but I, you know, now that I'm watching him from afar, you know, watching him outside of the Barca bubble, I don't want him back. I just don't like his style anymore. You know, at the time when he was on the team, obviously, you know, he scored goals, important goals for us. He was an exciting player. But to me, I just, you know, for me personally, I just have this idea of the people who want to play with Barca are more long-term players. You know, they want to play. They've either gone through the academy, or they're just the type of, they're a different type of player, you know, that want to play for Barca. And like you said, I just feel scorned by Neymar, especially just going to PSG. You know, it's just kind of, it's to me, I just can't get over that decision, because, you know, just on playing the Clásico, like, to me, how do you give that up? Playing that two times a year, worldwide views, like the whole importance of that match to go play against Rennes,
right,
or Lyon. Like, you know, it's just like, this doesn't make sense to me. But again, to each his own, right? And they asked a bunch of people in Barcelona in the past couple of days, would you take him back? And again, if we were looking at strictly financial, I would say no, because obviously he's going to cost way too much. Right?
Yeah.
That's the thing. And most people are saying, yeah, I'd take him back for if the transfer fee was €1. But that's the only, you know, that's the only sentiment, you know, because everyone knows it's going to, you know, Paris is going to try to rob us back, you know, for that, you know. So,
yeah. And there really isn't much love between PSG and Barcelona. It seems to be
exactly
a fairly contentious relationship between the two clubs.
I mean, I can see him going to Madrid first before he comes to Barcelona again.
Oh, man. Go to Atletico. That would be interesting.
That's not going
to
happen.
No, I know. Go to Sevilla. Play with Munir.
Yeah. I mean, if obviously with the way Madrid is playing and they have no kind of superstar really in the attacking, I could see them really going after him this summer, and especially pairing him up with Vinicius, the new 18-year-old Brazilian guy, who I think is not that good. I think he's super overrated, but whatever. He does all those. He does all those little bicicletas. You know, he's always like doing the over with the step over. I'm just like, dude, everyone's gonna have the book on you in like 2 months, man. And anyway,
well, so it's a question. I mean, because Ronaldo used to do that a lot, and then he started doing it less.
But he
sort of grew.
Yeah, yeah, but he kind of invented it. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was back in the day when it first was happening. Mm-hmm. But now the Vinicius guy, this is all he does. And he and the players are just trying to get used to him again because he does it so often. And once they figure that out, you can only do that move so many times. But anyway, right. I can see him going to Madrid. I think he's going to be too expensive for Barcelona. Mm.
See, I think if Barcelona turns him down, and like you said, they probably will for these financial reasons, I think he should look to England.
No way. He would. No way. That's like the polar opposite of, like, you know, where he would want to go. I mean, I could see obviously for the notoriety, but just the style of play alone and the pitch, no way.
Okay.
It just wouldn't suit him at all. I mean, Paris already is a cold enough place for him to play. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I'm just thinking of English clubs.
Yeah,
certain English clubs, Liverpool especially, they do tend to look to Brazil for some of their talent, yeah, and other parts of South America. So maybe he would have more of his, you know, countrymen around. And yeah, the actual climate, like you said, it would be very cold and muddy, and probably not his liking.
Like I said, my gut feeling is that he's going to go to Madrid.
Yeah,
like, that's my ultimate. I just think that, especially the status of Madrid right now, especially with the low attendance that they've been having this year, I think they really need a Galactico again. And I think Perez will definitely try and inquire and see what it costs to bring Neymar.
Do you think if he does go to Real, do you think it's better that he went there through PSG to kind of soften that blow of leaving Barcelona for Madrid?
Yeah, but at the same time, I don't know. You know, like when Figo did it, it wasn't as though Figo came from La Masia or something, right? I mean, he had some years, but like, you have a good point. I think it's definitely not going to be as bad. But also, just the way football is with free agency and the transfers, there's really kind of no loyalty. So it's not as serious as it was back in the day when Figo went from Barcelona to Madrid.
Yeah, but I feel like so many Barcelona fans still insist on that kind of loyalty.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that, but
like,
for me,
a
I wouldn't
special in that way.
Yeah, yeah, but for me, it just doesn't. It's not as serious. I think I remember when Figo left, that was more of a blow to me because, you know, Figo was like the world player of the year, you know, and he was so important to Barcelona. When he left, it was such a big deal. I remember that happened. I was like, what is he doing? You know?
Yeah. So it was first of all just the fact that he was leaving, and then insult to injury. He goes to Real Madrid.
Exactly.
This is
exactly.
Very different.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, it was in that time, too, where we needed him. You know, that's the other thing. It wasn't as though we just had a stable of amazing players. You know, we did have good players, but he was so vital to our success in that season. And so, you know, for me, like I said, you know, Neymar played, what, 4 seasons with us?
Yeah.
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 And to me, he didn't come through the academy. He was a mercenary. And he went to PSG. And he went to Madrid. Eh.
It'll just be
someone we got to fight against, you know?
Yeah, just another guy.
Yeah.
All right, well, you know, did you hear about the UEFA Fans Team of the Year? It was just announced, I guess, yesterday or day before?
No, I just saw that there was a bunch of Madrid players on it, of course.
Right. Yeah, so this was the like a best 11 in Europe based on fan voting on UEFA's website. And, yeah, like you mentioned, a lot of Real Madrid. But Messi was on it, obviously. But what I want to mention is that Ter Stegen was on it as well. It was his first time on this particular, best 11 thing. Now, Real Madrid was, as you mentioned, more represented on the team, the most represented on this team with 4 of the 11 from Real. But Ter Stegen, so that means Ter Stegen beat out the likes of De Gea, Courtois, Neuer. And so I think the voting shows that there is not a strong Barcelona bias in the voting, and yet Ter Stegen still gets top goalkeeper on this team. So I like that because I think it just means that people are really starting to recognize how good Ter Stegen is.
Yeah, I mean, like we say, he's a top 4 goalkeeper in the world, you know, and I think until he becomes Germany's absolute number one, then I think that's really going to put him over the top because people still think that Neuer is better than him. And I would take Ter Stegen right now, you know, because of Neuer's age. And until he's the absolute number one, then that'll just come with the credibility. Oh, wow, he's been with Barca for so long and he's been doing really well. I mean, we're going to talk about his save of the year, but he's just, you know, for the last 3 seasons, he just keeps getting better and he keeps stabilizing the defense and becoming, you know, he's going to be a captain. of the team pretty soon. So, you know, he's heading in that direction. He's still young. He's still probably going to play for Barca for like 10 years. So,
yeah. So, and he's been sort of like a backup captain on one or two occasions in like, not Copa del Rey, but just, you know, those games where all the youngins went out. He's had the armband on, and it's just a matter of time before he's, you know, one of the set captains at the beginning of the year for sure.
Let me ask you this. So, you know, before when Ter Stegen started with the team, you know, there were some times when he played in the back and you kind of be nervous a couple times, but now you never have that feeling anymore, right? He's solid with his feet. He makes the right decisions. He makes great saves. You know, he's good in the air. So again, I remember there was maybe 2 years ago where there was a couple long ball goals on him where he gave up, you know, on those goals. There was a couple times where you felt nervous about his passing and so forth, but now he's rock solid, man. There's like no doubt that he's the number one for Barca.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, his first year when both he and Bravo came in, and Bravo was actually getting more starts than him and he was coming on, that was when he would make me the most nervous. And mainly it was when he decided to come out of the box and, you know, how he was gauging that. It seemed like he was making a lot of poor decisions. But then the next year, he was still doing that, but less, and he just kept working and kept working. And now he's, like you said, he's absolutely rock solid. He's absolutely our number one. And he's, I think, number one in the world. But like you said, he's not going to get the full notoriety for that until he's Germany's number one.
Yeah, like I said, because with that comes, you know, because Germany is always known for great goalkeeping. And so when you become the German number one, like absolute, then that just comes, that'll help with the credibility. And like the other thing, until you hear on ESPN FC that he is the best goalkeeper, then that's really going to put it over the top for me. Because they always say the guy from Liverpool and Man City, and I mean, they haven't won anything, you know, like that's part of the thing of being a number one goalkeeper. It's not only do you have the physical tools, but also your career resume. Do you win? Because that you ultimately are helping the team to win.
Yeah, exactly. Now, speaking of voting and awards, this leads us straight into the Barca Talk Awards. This is for this season so far, right? So we have a couple of awards that we want to bestow on the Barcelona players. First up is Primo Football.
Yeah, so we put this to Twitter and our Patreon page, and basically people were just saying, put any goal or Primo Football play with Alba and Messi, and that's it, you know? and so I went digging through the YouTube archives, and I was looking, and I said, what's, you know, not only a great goal, but what was kind of an important goal too, and a play. And I think for me, the Primo Football play was Messi's goal against Tottenham in the Champions League. Now, you know, during this time, we were not playing as well, you know, because we were struggling a little bit. We weren't, you know, playing as good as we were at the end of the first half of the season. And we were going to Wembley. So there was a lot of concerns how we were going to do. We were still fighting for the Champions League group. And obviously Tottenham was still alive. But I don't know if you remember this goal, Brian, but this goal was just, you know, just a great play because it involves four players. Of course, Messi starts to play. He's in the center of the park. He finds Alba streaking on the left. Gives it to Alba. Alba obviously makes a move, centers the ball. Then basically Coutinho dummies, then Suarez dummies, and Messi, because no one's tracking him through the middle, one times it. And it's not even a shot. It's like a hard guided pass, past Lloris, and it's just a brilliant goal. And from start to finish, for me, especially for the moment that it was, it just clinched that match as well. That's my Primo Football Award winner.
Yes, absolutely. I do remember that goal. And as you were describing it, I felt the goose flesh on my skin pop up, because that was indeed the acme of Primo Football. So good selection.
I mean, for me, I love, you know, we've seen Suarez do too many dummies sometimes, but when it works brilliantly.
And this was a double dummy.
It was a double dummy.
This was dummy and dummier.
Yeah.
And then Messi comes in.
And then Messi just comes in like a shark, you know, just does not take any prisoners and slots it past. And it's just for example, if I were going to take that opportunity as a goal, I'm going to try to kick the shit out of the ball from that, you know, and hope that it goes in, you know. But Messi is super professional, calm under pressure, and just guides it perfectly where Lloris can't get to it. So.
Yeah, he knows where he wants to go with it, and he knows how to do it. So next award was the save of the year. Of course, this goes to Ter Stegen, but what was the specific save?
Yeah, I mean, as we just talked about, Ter Stegen is having a great campaign this season so far, and I looked at the, you know, some of the nominees and so forth, but the save of the year for me was the double save moment against Sevilla earlier this year in the 61st minute. You know, there was a header that was free. Ter Stegen was outstretched, makes it like, you know, poster type of save, you know, the type of save that you put on a poster. He's fully outstretched, palms it, puts it away, and there just happens to be a Sevilla attacker, and he takes it, and Ter Stegen just bounces right up, gets big, as you're taught to get big with all your hands and your body, and the attacker from Sevilla tries to kick it through his legs, and he closes it down and, you know, doesn't allow the goal in that opportunity. So Sevilla had two clean shots, and Ter Stegen was able to deny both of those, and for me, that is the save of the year so far.
Oh, absolutely. Again, I remember this very clearly, just as you describe it. Save of the year, no doubt. Hopefully we'll see more. Well, I hope we don't see more saves like that, because when he has to be making saves like that, that means we're breaking down a little bit. But the fact that we have him there is super important. Now, newcomer of the year.
So it was funny because when we were talking about this award, you know, I told you, oh, it's probably going to be Dembele. But then you brought it up that we actually signed him last season. So I just kind of forgot about that. So we had to kind of change our gears. And for me, the newcomer of the year, without a doubt, is Clément Lenglet. I mean, for me, that has been such a great signing, right? He's young. He wasn't too expensive. Since he's been plugged in because of Umtiti's injury, he's been solid in the back. You saw it against Levante on Thursday. We put him in there. All of a sudden, our defense was completely solid. We didn't have that much pressure. We didn't have these many counters. And Lenglet also has a goal this season. And to me, he is the future, especially with him and Umtiti. They're going to be a great pairing going forward as long as Umtiti's knee gets resolved. But for me, this signing has been brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I think he was a fantastic signing. And he is even kind of a similar center back to Piqué in how he reads the game. He is definitely the more cerebral, tallish, slender center back. And I look forward in time, and I have a vision of the French Connection there in the back. Him and Umtiti, you know, Umtiti being the big muscle, the big man, the wall, but also who could shut down plays, and Lenglet, who kind of like outthinks you. I think especially the thing about Lenglet is, again, his ability to read the game. We saw on Thursday in Copa del Rey, we'll talk about this more, how, you know, Tchouaméni, he's younger, and, you know, he wasn't doing so great. He wasn't anticipating these plays, and that's fine, you know, but because he's young. But then you put Lenglet in and everything settles down because he just reads things better. He anticipates the plays better, and he can manage those attackers more successfully. So as we see Piqué go out, we're going to see Lenglet and Umtiti holding down a really strong central defense. And I have no doubt that eventually Umtiti's knee is going to get sorted out. Maybe not this season. It's going to be a tough season for him as far as coming back, or, you know, what is he doing. But over the long term, I think his knee is going to be fine, and we're going to have Lenglet and Umtiti. So yeah, great newcomer of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I would consider Lenglet like an elegant defender.
Ooh, yes.
You know? So
elegant.
He doesn't go to ground too often, but when he does, it's the right time. He reads the game well, he passes well, he's good in the air. Just like Piqué. I would say Piqué is an elegant defender. When I think of him, I don't think of, you know, like a John Terry kind of brute force type of defender that's really physical. He just knows how to put his body in front and just kind of reads the game because he has an attacking mind, and that gives him an advantage to kind of see the plays develop. And so, you know, that's what you kind of need. You need these type of defenders, and Lenglet has just, you know, at the beginning of the season when he wasn't getting much playing time, I was kind of worried, but obviously since Umtiti's injury, he's plugged in very nicely.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, the Hamfoot play of the year. Of course, this is the award named in honor of Luis Suarez and his ham foot. And it's a hard category to give an award for. So we don't have an award for this category. The reason it's hard is because no one keeps stats or commentaries on ham footed plays, on bad touches. It's actually my favorite award. I wish had we been thinking ahead more about this, we could have really notated, as we were watching their games, some really good ham-footed moments. But you just think back and you know, there were definitely some, but you can't quite remember when.
How about all of September with Luis Suarez?
Yeah. Well, I do think that we should give the award to Suarez this year, just because he's, you know, he is the namesake of the award, and he definitely has, we know he's had some ham-footed plays. The other nominee, of course, came from our listener, Zach, who mentioned the Valladolid match where everyone was playing ham-footed because the pitch was a disaster.
That's a good one, too. But, you know, I would say Luis Suarez for September because as he was playing himself into shape, right, he looked a little chunky. He wasn't in shape as much. And every time he would try to do the dummy run, it was wrong. When he tried to make a through ball, it was too heavy. And everything was just going wrong for him. I mean, obviously, he's eventually found his form. But, you know, Suarez is kind of one of those guys that doesn't really focus that much anymore on preseason training and just kind of uses that first month to get his – to get going. And so I would say Luis Suarez, the month of September.
Absolutely. So those were the first annual Barca Talk Awards. We'll have another edition next year, and we'll try and keep track of some ham-footed plays more so that we can have better nominees next year for the ham foot. Now, there's been a major shakeup in the women's team, and now with more on that, here's our Barca women correspondent, Michelle Taylor.
The surprising news for Barca Femini last week was the dismissal of Fran Sanchez, now replaced by U.S. Cortez. It wasn't so much the sacking that was the surprise, rather it was the timing. Barca isn't known to be a reactionary club, so for this to happen meant that there was more going on behind the scenes, which indeed there was. Sanchez's appointment to the role in 2017 was one that came out of the blue. A former coach at La Masia until 2012, he left the club to become the technical director of the Bahrain national team and also worked as assistant manager at Maccabi Tel Aviv in Israel. Former women's coach Xavi Arens, after announcing his retirement, was instrumental in bringing Sanchez back to the club to coach the women's team. A surprise to most, as the expectation was that Argentinian Cristian Toro, who had just resigned as coach of Valencia, would be appointed to the role. At least that's what most of us had hoped would happen. However, in came Fran. As I've mentioned before, the frustration with Sanchez stemmed mostly from his timid approach to games, in which Barca was losing or struggling to score. He wasn't quick enough to make tactical changes, and his subs were often untimely and made no sense. Perhaps his best performances were in the Champions League leagues against Olympique Lyon. Away, the score was 2-1, and at the mini, Lyon won 0-1. Extremely good results against the powerhouse of women's football, a team which frequently scores over 5 goals per game. But the result was largely based on our defensive approach, particularly in the game at the mini. We offered very little in attack, as the aim appeared to be to contain Lyon, stop them from scoring too many, and hopefully score on a counter-attack. But the result was largely based on our defensive approach, particularly in the game at the mini. We offered very little in attack, as the aim appeared to be to contain Lyon, to stop them from scoring too many, and hopefully score on a counter-attack. Sanchez's management of the players was suspect as well. The lack of rotation, a favoured starting 11, the freezing out of Olga Garcia, and marginalising others such as Marta Unzue and Ruth Garcia didn't go down very well. Olga, now at Atleti and performing very well, was left at a loss to understand. Sanchez wouldn't give her any explanation about why she wasn't being selected and generally shunned her at all times. She has described last season as the worst season of my life at the club of my life. Extremely shoddy treatment for any player, especially one who had arrived at the club when she was 12 years old and, apart from a 2-year stint at Levante, had been a Blaugrana player for 12 years. After losing the Liga again last season, the team won the Copa de la Reina and avoided going trophyless. After doubling club investment in the team, reinforcing with strong foreign and Spanish players, as well as promoting 3 from the La Masia ranks, Barca made it clear to Sanchez that winning the Liga was the priority. And that's all we've heard in every interview that team members have given this season. The Liga is the competition to win. A month ago, the 4 team captains, Vicky Losada, Marta Torrejon, Alexia Putellas and Sandra Paños, met with the women's section director, Maria Teixidor. Among topics discussed was that the Liga was the priority. The team finished the first half of the season 1 point behind Atleti Madrid. The first game back after Christmas on January the 6th was the derby against Espanyol. Not an opposition that we usually worry about, but the game finished in an extremely frustrating nil-all draw, which was like the Valencia result all over again. We had the possession and all the chances, but no success. We even got a penalty, which really should have been judged as an accidental ball to hand, but Vicky's shot hit the post. So we dropped to 3 points behind Atleti. But the messages coming from Sanchez and the team after the game were still positive, and that it was in their hands to win the Liga. Then, out of the blue, came the club announcement that Sanchez had been sacked. The players were on a day off and, according to reports, were very surprised at the decision. They had known that had they lost the game to Atleti early in the season, that Sanchez would probably have been gone then. But they didn't expect his dismissal after the Espanyol game. For the club, it was a drawn game too far, the third draw for the season. The game against Levante was fair enough, but the 2-0 all games against Valencia and now Espanyol were unacceptable, and Sanchez paid the price for the team's performance, which wasn't up to scratch. Given that the team is still unbeaten in the Liga this season, the decision to dismiss Sanchez is a real indicator that the club's expectations for the women's team have been set very high. Barca held a press conference on Thursday to introduce Luis Cortez as the new manager. At the conference, the club's second vice president and former head of La Masia, Jordi Mestre, said this: "We have been increasing investment in the women's section because we want to have a championship team. We can't afford another year without winning titles. There has been a qualitative leap in both investment and transfers. The dismissal of Sanchez has not been an impulsive decision, but one that has been escalating in recent weeks." Women's sporting director Markel Zubizarreta added, "Luis Cortez will continue with the women's project according to the plan, but a little change in team dynamics was required." So what about Luis Cortez? He holds a bachelor's degree in physical activity and sports sciences, as well as one in advertising and public relations. More importantly, he has 4 years of coaching women's team under his belt as coach of the Catalunya under-12, under-16 and under-18 teams, as well as the senior Catalunya women's team. Cortez was signed to Sanchez's management team last season and came on board as an analyst to study opposing teams, tactics and playing styles. He was appointed to third coach for this season. Now he's El Mister, the boss. At the press conference, the soundbites included ubiquitous club statements such as, "We will move forward to achieve the ambitious challenges set by the club, thanks to the investment made in the team." And, "We want to win every game playing well in the Barca style." More tellingly, he added, "I expect all the players to improve their performances and to play better." Something that players Alexio Putellas and Mappy Leon have said in recent interviews when they expressed that the team, with all its talent, should be playing better than they are. Only time will tell if those comments were aimed at Fran Sanchez and his tenure as the women's coach. Visca Barça y Força Barça Femení.
That was Michelle Taylor. Follow at Barça Women on Twitter for regular news and updates on the women's team. And now, is Barca B the quarry for the first team it's so famously made out to be, or is it the quarry for other clubs? Our Barca B correspondent Max Bleuer takes a look at the B team's business in this transfer window.
As we find ourselves deep in the January transfer window, now seems like a good time to discuss Barca B's transfer strategy and the radical overhaul it has undergone since last season. In the summer of 2017, Barca B made a number of signings of relatively experienced players, most of whom were in their mid-20s. Players like José Anaíz, Anthony Lozano and Inigo Ruiz de Galarreta, while the likes of David Costas and David Concha even arrived on loan from other La Liga clubs. Barça B seemed to have turned into a finishing school for other clubs' youngsters. Costas, for example, after having made 38 appearances in Segunda last year for Barça B, has gone on to become an important member of Celta Vigo's first team squad this year. Barcelona as a club, and Eric Abidal's predecessor as director of football, Roberto Fernández, has clearly prioritised maintaining Barça B's place in Segunda over the development of La Masia players. And you can see their reasoning for this. After all, the jump to the first team is far easier from Segunda than Segunda División B. At least in Segunda, you are playing against professionals, in front of large crowds, and in some of the grand old stadiums of Spanish football, El Molinón, Riazor, or La Romareda. In Segunda B, though, the boys have more often than not been playing in front of one man and his dog against semi-pros in non-existent atmospheres. So buy or loan a few players with a bit more experience and mix them up with the innate talent emerging from La Masia, and hopefully the squad will be strong enough to stay up, thereby smoothing the transition from juveniles to B team to first team. The theory might have been sound, but it turned out horribly. Barça B finished last season in 20th place, 4 points and 2 places away from safety, with the final game of the season epitomising everything that had gone wrong. A 2-0 loss to Zaragoza at home in the Mini-Estadi, when the season's only bright spot, Carlos Alenia, tore his hamstring, and a wonder goal was scored by Alex Fabas, a Real Madrid loanee. Barça B failed to stay up last year, and the policy of signing older, more experienced players did nothing more than block the progress of the youngsters further down the pecking order. Thankfully, the club seems to have learnt from the catastrophe that was the last campaign. Only 2 signings were made for the B team last summer. Moussa Wage, a 20-year-old right-back who scored at the World Cup for Senegal for about €5 million, and Ronald Araujo, a 19-year-old Uruguayan centre-back. While joining them this week was Ignacy Villarraza, who was recalled from loan in order to cover for Miranda at left-back when he's with the first team. Wagen and Araujo are additions to a squad, the core of which is made up of youngsters who have been at the club since childhood. Players like Ricky Puig, Miranda and Chumi regularly take part in first-team training sessions and have had minutes with the first team this season. While the change in director of football has undoubtedly been important, the man behind the transformation in Barcelona's transfer strategy, the pivot towards players brought up in La Masia, is undoubtedly Francesc García Pimienta. Pimi, as he's known, has been developing players at La Masia since 2001, and as such knows the place and his players better than anyone. He was promoted in the summer to manage the B team and facilitate the integration into the team of the numerous juvenil players who had been promoted to play in Segunda B. The number of external signings has dropped dramatically under his tenure. He proudly mentioned in a recent interview with Mundo Deportivo that 80% of his players are from La Masia, far removed from last season when the likes of Vitinho or Matias Noel blocked those same players from the team and failed to keep Barcelona up. Pimi also let slip a couple of other interesting points in that interview. For example, his opinion that only 4 or 5 of his squad had the potential to make it to the first team. Presumably that includes Miranda, Chumi and Puig, who have all had minutes with the first team, as have Oriol Busquets and Jorge Cuenca, while Abba Ruiz, Carlos Perez, Alex Caiado and others have all shown plenty of promise. Yet not everyone is convinced that the transfer strategy has truly changed and that it will last. One such example is Roberto Navarro, who's imaginatively named his son Robert and later played a key role in his boy's switch from La Masia to AS Monaco, where he's been recently made his debut for the first team, aged just 16. Navarro Sr. has also been chatting in the media, and in the interview with Sport, he accused Pep Segura, a key decision-maker at La Masia, of not believing in Barca DNA. To be sure, there has been tension between the club and Navarro over the manner of his departure, with Barca accusing the player and his father of making unreasonable financial demands. But at the same time, Navarro Jr. is far from the only bright La Masia prospect to have packed his bags to another club in the expectation of more first-team football. Sergio Gomez at Borussia Dortmund and Yuri Mbula, also at Monaco, spring to mind. Those youngsters clearly had some doubts over how they had progressed through the age groups at Barca and whether they would find their path to the first team and even the B team blocked. Seeing as the switch away from outside signings to focus on the younger age groups to find players for Barca B is less than a year old, it's too early to break open the champagne bottles and declare the return to the golden age of La Masia. In other, more immediate news, Barca B's first match 2019 was a disappointing 1-1 draw with Second Boston Castellón that featured a hilarious own goal by Rafa Mujica and an even more hilarious fight between a Castellón player and Guillem Serrano that saw the two of them sent off, though in reality it was nothing more than fisticuffs. The next game will be this weekend at home to Alcoyano before a trip to Ejea next Sunday. We should also mention the cup loss to Levante the first team had on Thursday. Miranda and Chumi both started but did not play well. Chumi in particular failed to cope with Levante's forward line and was hauled off shortly into the second half, while Miranda was subbed at half-time. Neither trained with the first team the following day, and Valverde failed to defend his two canteranos in the post-game press conference, all of which has added fuel to the accusations that he does not know how, or is at least reluctant, to integrate youngsters into the first team.
All right, let's talk about the first team, and let's begin with the Copa del Rey. This, of course, happened on Thursday against Levante in the Alfonso Perez in Valencia, and it was a 2-1 loss, which I mostly attribute to the lineup, our lineup.
Yeah. You know, we talk about this theory, right, about going with the young guns. And so for the lineup, I was okay with the lineup, okay? But with me, I just think the idea of having the defensive four that we had and not have any kind of support formation-wise, I think was the wrong way to go. I think, you know, we could have gone into a 4-4-2 to help a little bit more stability, at least for the first 30 minutes, just to kind of get going. At least you have four midfielders to help track back on defense. But for me, the lineup wasn't too bad. Obviously, we're going to dive into the player performances and stuff, but we had, you know, Cillessen in goal. I thought Semedo, Murillo, Chumi, and Miranda, I thought that was okay. Vidal as the babysitter, as we talked about.
Vidal and Busquets, but Vidal was more and the Busquets, babysitter. Yeah. And Vidal was running all over the park trying to shut things down, put out fires. He was the fireman in this.
He was the fireman. So we had Vidal, Alenia, Busquets, you know, and Coutinho, Malcolm, and Dembele. So, you know, for like I said, I wanted to see this. But again, this kind of goes back to the whole thing this season. You know, I think Miranda should have had a spot start earlier in the season, so that he's not completely inundated with what's going on in this match. And also with Chumi, too, and obviously with Murillo, he, you know, I didn't expect much from him because this was going to be his first match. He wanted to prove that he was worth signing. And again, I blame more about the formation, just not being more conservative at the beginning and just letting those defenders find their feet and chemistry and then kind of build up from that.
Yeah, well, I mean, between the two center backs, definitely I thought Murillo looked good, especially for his first time out. I thought, wow, you know, he's a good signing.
You know, it's one of those things, Brian, where like when you're playing with this new team, right, if they don't give up that goal in the first 10 minutes, then all of a sudden you kind of build that confidence that you're like, okay, we put out that fire. We did this. Okay, we're doing okay. We're surviving. But once that first goal came in the first 8 minutes, I was like, oh God, just hold it together. Just hold it together. And I didn't want any drastic changes either because they have to figure it out. That's part of the plan, because once you try to save it, then they just don't get confidence going forward.
Yeah, and Valverde, I think, made it pretty clear with not just the starting 11, but the bench too, that he was going to ride or die with mostly the young guns, right? Because Messi didn't even come along.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, for me, I would only have made two changes to this lineup. I would have not started Busquets because, you know, people on Twitter were clamoring, you know, obviously with his biggest flop that he did with Cillessen. But also, you know, Busquets is at an age now where playing on a Thursday night in Valencia, Copa del Rey, like, you know, just give him a break. Let put Denis Suarez in there or put Sergio Roberto. Put someone else that's younger that's going to help you because you need the legs. And for me, I would have taken Dembele out. I would have used Denis Suarez, for example, because I think with Denis Suarez's situation that he's in right now, he's going to give you more effort than Dembele.
Yes, I agree, especially because, you know, he's trying to fight for minutes or he's trying to get a little something on the highlight reel, because keep hearing rumors that he might go to Arsenal. See how that develops. But I think you're right. In a game like this, he would have gone after it a lot more. In fact, when he came on and he got that penalty, he was really turning it on. That was a good dribble that he was right in the middle of. Meanwhile, Dembele, you know, he didn't quite have the professionalism to really go after it as much.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up, you know, two points that I wanted to talk about. So the first one was Dembele. You know, like as a professional coach, not only are you supposed to be really good at tactics and understanding the game, but you're also kind of a psychologist as well. I mean, especially at this professional level, these players making so much money. And to me, like, I don't know Dembele personally, but just from afar, I know he's not going to be up for a Copa del Rey match on a Thursday night. He'd rather be playing Fortnite.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's the thing, right? So understand those type of things, those tendencies. Like I have here in my notes, I would have used Denis Suarez. I mean, obviously, we're playing advocate after he did such a great performance in those 10 minutes. But I know personally that Denis Suarez is going – well, not personally, but I know Denis Suarez is probably going to try a little bit harder because he's fighting for those minutes, you know? And that to me was a bad call, because you saw Dembele's passing was super lazy. He did not track back to help Semedo. He left Coutinho all by himself a bunch of times. And when he did have opportunities, he didn't shoot the ball.
Right.
Right. That was driving me crazy, Brian, you know, because yes, he has that move, but at the same time, just shoot the ball.
Right.
You're playing Levante. You don't, this is not Bayern Munich or something like this.
Yeah. Just
now going back to the Denis Suarez. Yeah. Going back to the Denis Suarez thing. You know, he had a great 10-minute spell there. You know, at first I was kind of making fun of it. I even tweeted, Denis Suarez, save us, por favor. You know, that's what I said. And he made me eat my own words, you know? And so he definitely had some really good movement, especially in that top right. We've never really seen him in that top right corner as a 4-3-3. And he just looked after it, you know? And it was, I mean, you could definitely see how it just changed the mood of the team because of his movement. We weren't going horizontal so much. We were going a little bit more vertical.
Yeah. Now, the other note that you had, because you wanted to talk about Coutinho and how he didn't look so hot in this match either.
Yeah, this, you know, we talked about this. You know, we want Coutinho to perform. We need him. And I think this was the worst case scenario that could have happened, because not only did he look like he didn't belong there, but also he just looked like a player that doesn't have confidence. And most importantly, you know, we needed him to be the top star to lead the team, especially when we're down 1-0, you know. He lost the ball so many times, Brian, 17 times. It's whenever he was supposed to go left, he was supposed to go right. When he went right, he was supposed to go left. I mean, every play that he did was the wrong move. And, you know, it's very troubling because Valverde's basically said he has to fight harder in training.
Mm.
You know, and last time I checked, there isn't a biometric meter that you can gauge how hard a player is fighting for, you know, because that's, it's one of those arbitrary things. He's not fighting hard enough, you know? You know, so this is a little bit troubling because, like I said, we need him going forward. We paid so much money for him. He had an amazing World Cup campaign, and now it's he's basically a shadow of that person.
Yeah, and when we first got him, for months, he just kept getting better and better and stronger. And I think it's just the fact that Dembele has been showing up so much more lately that Coutinho's lost some time, and that's okay. But I, like you mentioned, how, you know, a manager has to be a psychologist as well. And I think that Coutinho's not plugged in right now, and Valverde is not interested in trying to get him plugged in. And that's a problem because we spent all this money on him. Two, he's an incredible talent, an incredible player. He's, you know, he's not Dembele, he's different, but he has a lot of qualities. So I think it's that Valverde just doesn't have the ideas.
I agree. You know, the thing is, Valverde is happy with the lineup that he has, our strongest lineup, because it's getting results, and that's all he really cares about right now. To me, you have to kind of have both, because you never know when injury is going to happen, and we're going to need Coutinho, you know? And then when we need Coutinho and he doesn't have good performances, it's like, well, we need him. And Valverde is going to be stuck, you know, in this type of thing, you know? It's the manager's job, especially at a team like Barcelona, where there's so many superstar players, is to find appropriate playing time, have everyone plugged in, as you said, that's a great word, and ready to fight when they're asked to. You know, you have to find a spot for Coutinho, whether he rotates with Artur on the left as a midfielder and just get him acclimated to that. But you need him. We need him because he is a talent.
Yeah, and it just makes me – I keep coming back to this with Valverde, which is that I'm basically happy with – I'm happy with his results, of course, and I'm basically happy with his managing, more or less, but I just don't – I think there's something missing with Valverde as a manager at Barcelona, which is that he is – he seems to me like someone who's happy with good enough. He's happy with – getting these results, and this is the lineup I'm getting these results with, so I'm going to stick with that lineup. He doesn't have a larger idea or a larger vision. And you go back to, you know, Saint Pep, he had a whole program in his mind. He saw the whole thing. He looked at the entire squad and he saw possibility for everyone and everything. And that's what he does. And Valverde is more like, well, that worked. Let's do that again. That's good enough. And that's not good enough at Barcelona.
That is a great point, because I was just thinking about that it's a very Spanish type of attitude to have, that you're doing okay and that's fine. Yeah. You know, it's a very Mediterranean type of attitude, you know, I'm okay. It's cool. We're winning. But like you said, we don't, you know, that's what makes the managers like Pep, let's say, that have this out of the box thinking of the whole program and how you're going to use players, you know? And like I said, you got to think of these different ways, because you'd never know when we're going to need Coutinho. Coutinho cost more than 100 million euros. Like,
yeah,
it's not just
not
a player. Yeah. It's not a player you can just put on the bench. He's not a Mounir, you know?
Right.
Like, come on.
All right. Now, finally, you had one, you had a couple other notes about this. Let's talk about defensive woes.
Yeah. So this just goes back to, you know, this is kind of my theory about national team playing too with football, is that, you know, the reason why Spain did so well in the 2010 World Cup, for example, is because you had a lot of players that played club together. So they knew how to pass and what to expect. I think you kind of have to use that same theory when you use this type of lineup. So maybe link up the back pairing with people who have some sort of history together so that they can depend on each other. So it's not just completely going into the fire blind, you know? And this kind of rolls into my point with Semedo. You know, Semedo was brutal in this match, man. I want more from him. You know, he is a physical specimen. And how many times did he get turned around against Levante?
Oh, yeah.
It's
he's capable of more. But like you have a note here that I totally agree with, which is that he plays down to his competition. Not only that, but as I was watching this match, I thought he plays down to his teammates as well.
That's a good point. I mean, he is fast. He doesn't get pushed over that much. But I mean, it was almost his first time playing football on the right back. Like, he didn't know how to turn, how to shade the person to the back. I was getting so frustrated with him because, you know, he is a good player. He has a lot of experience playing in big matches. And to me, against Levante, he has to be a leader. He has to be super solid on defense first, and everything else will come from it. I would rather have him be a lockdown defender on that right back than not attack at all, to have that stability, because that will give everyone else more confidence playing defense. But man, it's like one of those things in American football, they teach you to look at the belly button of a player that's coming at you, because if he turns left, then that's where the hips are going to go, and that's where you go. And to me, it just looks like he's just looking at the head the whole time. And so the guy fakes left, and he's like, oh my God, and he falls down. You know, it's like, and it's just, it's amateur defending. It's amateur defending. And to me, he is better than that. And like I said, how many times in his passes, you're just like, what are you thinking? You know, that's the other thing. His outlet passing is horrible too.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing is, like, you hit the nail on the head with the word leader, right? He is a good player, and he should have been a leader, because if you're standing in his position, you look down the line to your left, you've got Murillo, brand new signing, you've got Chumi, B-team player, and then down on the other end, you got Juan Miranda, another B-team player. You have to understand, you're the senior member of that line, and you have to lead that line. But I just don't think he's... I don't think he has those leadership qualities. He's a great player, and if you put him on a line with someone else who's a leader, he's going to do great. But if he has to be the leadership person, the leader on that line, it doesn't seem to be really like in his wheelhouse.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, he's a physical specimen. There's no reason why he shouldn't play tighter on these guys, because a person with the ball dribbling and running is going to be slower than you without the ball, always. I mean, Messi's the only one that doesn't do that, but everyone else, you know, you dribble with the ball, you're going to be slower. And Semedo should be able to be better physically on defense, man. It's such a liability.
Yeah, and again, this all comes back to Valverde for me, you know, just understanding your players and, you know, managing your players well, understanding what their qualities are, how they deal with different teammates and different configurations. I mean, for me, like, so much comes back to the manager, because we have great players. We have a lot of great talent, and an even better manager would be getting that much more out of these guys, but we're getting good enough.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing, you know, if we were in a 4-4-2 at the beginning, just more conservative that way, dropping Coutinho back even further down just to be a better outlet for Miranda, because how many times did Miranda lose the ball that directly led to a counter, you know, because there was such a great distance between our midfield and the defense, right? So if you just bring Coutinho back, and then you have Malcolm and Dembele up there just for the first 30 minutes, just for the defense, so they can get their bearings and their communication. That's all you have to do. I mean, these are just slight adjustments that you do that would make a huge difference. And then going in halftime, if it's 1-0 or 0-0, then all of a sudden you can start making tactical adjustments to try to score the goal. But you have to understand these type of things. Again, just like you said, it's just good enough.
Yeah. Now, for the second leg, because we did get that penalty and Coutinho scored on it, so good on him. We wound up 2-1. So we got an away goal, and Levante is going to be coming to Barcelona for the second leg. I know that we agree that in the second leg, Valverde should go with not the exact same lineup, but the same idea, right? Keep it with the youngsters. Reserve Copa del Rey for the youngsters. Do you think he's going to actually do that?
No.
Yeah, I agree, because I mean, he wants to advance.
I think he's... Yeah, I mean, I would love to have the same lineup and just maybe put Sergio Roberto instead of Semedo back there, and then put Denis Suarez instead of Dembele.
Yeah, I think that sounds great.
You know, those two little changes I think would make a big difference. And then, because I think Sergio Roberto can lead, and knowing that he's the senior person on that line, I think will definitely help. But I think we should give Miranda another chance, because he needs to get this playing time. He did make mistakes, but the only way he's going to get better is to learn. So next game you say, okay, look, you know, the players are faster now. So that 15-yard pass that you did in Barca B is going to get intercepted. It's got to be closer, and it's got to be a little bit over it. And Chumi too. You know, I think Chumi and Murillo just develop a little bit more. and ride or die. Because to me, you know, if we lose in the Copa del Rey, okay, you know, obviously I'm not going to be the happiest person, but at least we went with the Barca B, the youngsters, and at least they can have something going forward to lean on.
And finally, in La Liga on Sunday, Eibar came to town, and they left a little sad because we won 3-0. It was the first half was a little rough, but ultimately there was a lot of primo football in this match.
Yeah, I would say a lot of attempted primo football, right? Because they strung a lot of nice passes together, but ultimately they couldn't find the back of the net. But like you said, I would say maybe the first 30 minutes or so, they were just kind of trying to figure out Eibar's high pressing and how to escape it. You know, a lot of La Liga teams try this. And once Barcelona figured out, you know, the Rubik's Cube, they were having a lot of counter and goal chances opportunities.
Yeah. So what did you think of the lineup? I mean, I think the headline on the lineup, of course, is that Coutinho started.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, I definitely thought Dembele was going to get the start. And, you know, I got to give Valverde credit, you know, trying to get Coutinho some confidence playing with the big boys and to see if he could string it together. And, you know, I thought that was kind of a surprise. So how did you think Coutinho looked? Because on Twitter, people were flipping out on how great he looked tonight. But I have some other thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, I thought he looked good. And, you know, as far as his contributions to the goals, I think he was involved in all three of the goals in really clever, inventive ways. I think he was, you know, he was running hard. He was trying. And he had moments of brilliance. He didn't look necessarily mind-blowing from beginning to end. But, you know, like he had a lot of brilliant moments. He had some average moments. He had one or two not so great moments. So overall, I mean, I'd give his performance an A just because he was so involved with the goals in such great ways. But, you know, I don't think that that he like was head and shoulders above others.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, Twitter people love to really overreact and go over the top with this. I mean, yes, he did look much better than he did Thursday night.
Oh, sure.
But I just, you know, I think it's a combination of things. Obviously playing with Messi and Suarez, obviously he has that link up play down. And also just the midfield was much tighter with the passing. So it helped Coutinho string the attacking much better. You know, at the beginning of the match, he didn't look that great. I didn't think he lost the ball a couple times again, making bad passes. But then ultimately, when they were breaking the pass or the press, excuse me, and they had those counter up opportunities, Coutinho was making those really nice balls to Suarez. And then obviously that led to some nice primo football attempts. Now, I would like to see, you know, Coutinho and Dembele maybe rotate a little bit. And if that's the way to go, then I'm okay with that because I don't think we're losing anything. I mean, you saw when Dembele came in. Man, and when he's plugged in,
yeah,
he is a game changer, you know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, he's very fast.
Muy fast.
Muy fast. Well, now, do you have any insight on what Barcelona did to figure out Eibar's press and how they broke it down?
I mean, they just started to go wide. You know, they started to use the wings a little bit more. And also Artur and Sergio Busquets were starting to go through the middle a little bit more. So, you know, it's just patience really more than anything, because Eibar was kind of playing sometimes a 4-1-4-1. So you had this, you know, you had to break through that second line of four. And then from there, you had some more spacing. And again, it was just stringing the passes and being patient and just kind of working your way up the field. But also just having Coutinho and sometimes Suarez out wide to be the outlet. That ultimately is what happened. And they also, I don't know if you remember in the beginning, we were actually attempting some long balls from midfield as well. And that kind of just broke it up as well, because then Eibar had to be cognizant of those long balls as well.
Right. So even though those long balls didn't necessarily yield a whole lot, they at least got Eibar thinking defensively about how they're going to deal with that.
Exactly. There was a couple plays where Suarez broke free on a long ball and Coutinho did as well. And so that put a lot more pressure on Eibar's defense, where they had to be you know, more cognizant on those long balls. Now, you know, with this high press, you know, with Barcelona's touch and go, it's ultimately going to break three. It's just with patience and just trying to get through there.
Yeah. Now, the broadcast I was watching, by the end of the match, they had named Suarez as man of the match. And I have to say, I agree with that. And I think you do, too, because he really looked good in this match.
You know, we always talk about how underrated Messi is. And I would say tonight, Suarez, sometimes we just take for granted. Tonight, he was a beast. I mean, He played the typical number nine role. He was creating havoc. He looked fresh. He was running around. I mean, he had a super hand play at the end of the game. But for the most part, he was very plugged in, and he also had two goals as well. So, you know, he's going to be a tough player for us in the future to replace, because him and Messi just have a really nice chemistry. They know how to, you know, as we talked about in the awards earlier about the primo football play with the dummy, but also when the back pass that failed with the Messi's goal, but it was just a nice setup. Suarez, for me, yeah, definitely man of the match.
Yeah, and you know, that first goal he scored, the 19-minute goal, the whole buildup, I mean, talk about primo football, the whole buildup, starting off with the free kick from Arthur to Longley, back to Arthur, then Coutinho, back to Arthur, and then Busquets, and that's where the pivotal pass comes. Busquets, one touch from Arthur's pass to Coutinho, then it begins, right? Coutinho to Suarez, back to Coutinho, back to Suarez. Suarez gets down there and goal. And it was, I counted it, it was 10 touches amongst all these players in 12 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, it was such a nice play. Once they get that break on, you know, when we start to get them pedaling backwards, we have such an advantage with Messi and Coutinho and Suarez driving that attack. And just like you said, it was a really, as soon as Busquets hit that break, you know, it was on. And it was a great finish too from Suarez, because the ball was a little bit behind him when he shot the ball. That's why he fell. He always makes everything so dramatic. You know, he's like, ah, you know, but when he fell, it helped him with the angle. He was able to place it really nicely. So really nice finish. And if it wasn't going to go through, Coutinho was there for the follow-up as well. So, you know, I just think, you know, with Coutinho's play, I mean, you saw in this goal with the pass and also the follow-up, you know, obviously just playing with Messi and Suarez, he just feels, you know, at home, more comfortable, makes him play better. And again, it's up to Valverde when to choose Coutinho and Dembele, because I think both players, we need both players, and both players can really play well with Messi and Suarez.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I imagine playing with Messi and Suarez is helpful to anybody, but especially to someone like, you know, someone of Coutinho's caliber. Like, he wants to be playing off of guys with the quick feet and the quick minds of those two guys.
Exactly. And, you know, it's one of those things where there's like a unspoken communication, you know, where you just know where the player is going to go from passing and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, Coutinho, you know, definitely had an improved match from Thursday. But like you said, it was the patience of the back passing and then ultimately Busquets breaking that through with a really nice play. And then that, obviously, we just started with that attack and Ibar was on the back foot.
Yeah. And, you know, here's the other side of Coutinho, right? Because he was really great on that goal. But then he had the chance to make it 2-0 near the end of the second half. But then he went down, I thought, a little too easily in the box. He was calling for a penalty, you know, like a professional does. But it wasn't, there wasn't anything in it. The defender had a hand on his shoulder. He didn't hit his feet at all, you know. So either he dove or he just went down too easily. And I think that if he could have just fought through that little bit of contact, he would have been able to finish it and make it 2-0.
I mean, this is one of the hardest things to do because, you know, if he dives and gets the call, then great. It's a penalty and it's really easy, right? And we can say, yeah, he should, like, I personally think he should have fought harder for it, right? Like a running back almost, like, just let the defender ride your back even more, and then maybe you get the penalty call. But I think if he would have withheld him a little bit longer, I think he would have been able to get a pass or a shot off. And like you said, for me, it was really weak. It was a dive more than anything for me. And a lot of people on Twitter were complaining about the ref not being in the position to call, but he was there, and you know, it was a soft play. So for me, it was not a penalty.
Oh, no, not at all. And I mean, I watched the replay many, many times, and by no measure should that have been a penalty. So, yeah, so that, again, that comes back to Coutinho. Yes, he looked a lot better. He was playing with better players. He played in the last game, so he's, you know, he's a little bit more match ready. He hadn't played much prior to that. You know, we had the break and everything. So, you know, he definitely looked better than he did on Thursday, but there were still things like this that came up.
So what do you think of, like, this theory, maybe playing Coutinho two games, you know, and have Dembele come in for him, or like how he did today where Coutinho drops back to the midfield, and then have Dembele start two games and then do the vice versa. It's like just to kind of always have both of them playing often, because we're going to need them, both of them. You know, if we're down 1-0, Dembele can come in and save us, and vice versa. Coutinho can come in and maybe have that one shot where he comes in and scores a goal. So I think, you know, if Valverde can find some sort of rotation, because I think that's the only thing we're missing, right? Is, you know, we're more solid on defense. Our midfield with Artur is much better now. you know, when we have a big game, we have a strongest 11. And I just think going throughout the season, it's just trying to find a nice fit for Coutinho and Dembele to have equal opportunities and good playing time.
Yeah, I think it's, like you said, that's a good phrase, equal opportunities. I think it's important that both of them get roughly equal opportunities. Of course, Dembele has been preferred lately, and now Coutinho's got a couple of starts, which is nice, but then Dembele came in. So I don't know if I would insist that he systematize it too much, but I do think Valverde should be thinking a lot about balancing out Coutinho's time and Dembele's time and make sure that they're both, you know, feeling used, feeling valued, and they are actually having the time on the pitch so that when they do come out, they're not, you know, trying to get their bearings too much so that they can both be plugged in as we get into that, you know, that late tough period of the season, especially if we continue in the Copa del Rey where we're in all three competitions. And of course, we want to make a more concerted effort for the Champions League this year.
Yeah, definitely. We need everyone pulling on that rope, you know, because that's ultimately what's going to give us the doblete, hopefully, for the rest of the, or the end of the season.
Yeah. Now, another great headline out of this match is that Messi scored his 400th goal in La Liga in this match.
That's insane. I mean, I'm speechless, you know? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, before the match, they were talking about that on my commentating. They said, you know, if Messi scores, he scores his 400th. And I just kind of did double take, man. It's just, it's crazy how many goals. And, you know, this goal is like a very typical Messi. You know, as soon as he turned that corner, did you have a doubt in your mind that the ball was going in?
No.
I mean, I didn't.
as soon as
I saw that the keeper was out of play, I was like, that's a typical Messi goal. He loves that, turning that corner on the left. And, you know, he could have used Coutinho if he wanted to, but Messi just finished it. And it was just a very Messi clinical finish for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, he's leading the all-time La Liga scoring record by 89 goals now. And no one who's still active in La Liga is even close to him.
Yeah, not even by 100 goals, right? Or 200 even, maybe. I mean, it's crazy. Because I think the second one was Ronaldo, right?
Yeah. And yeah, so that's who he's leading by 89 goals. And now Ronaldo's off in Italy.
Yeah, now what is it, like Di Stefano, who's like dead, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's like Telmo Zarra, Hugo Sanchez, yeah. Raul, yeah. Di Stefano. Yeah, all the old guys.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, 400 goals, and, you know, like we say, it's just, it's insane how clinical he is and how consistent he's been ever since he's been a starter, you know, basically scoring more than 30 goals every season in the last 10 years. And it's just, it's insane. And, you know, this goal, you know, was just, he could have had another one too with the, as we said, the nice, really primo football play, but he kicked it into the goalkeeper's hands. But this one, you know, with the play, he was able to fight out the defender, go to the left, go around, and just find that low right angle corner that he loves, and he was able to put it away.
Yeah, and then that third goal, so Suarez's second goal, off the throw-in quickly taken by my boy Sergio Roberto, and then so I couldn't even believe it because I could have sworn Suarez was going to put it into the box, or, you know, put it back, but the pressure was coming in and he just put in this impossible finish.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as we talk about with these Barca players, you know, not only are they technically super sound, but I would say they have a high soccer IQ. And this was a perfect example of that, where Sergio Roberto took the opportunity, saw that, you know, the Eibar defense was sleeping a little bit. Suarez recognized it and they just did a quick throw in. And obviously Suarez took it to the corner. I thought for sure it went out of bounds because the commentator that I was watching was surprised. He's like, bueno, goal. And then he kind of went off on his goal thing. And I was kind of surprised as well because it wasn't, you know, he didn't kick it that hard, but he kicked it hard enough where it went right through the goalie's basically where his leg and his arm. So it was a really nice placement. I think also the goalkeeper was surprised by the whole action. You know, I think he was, you know, obviously he was going to try to block it, but I just think the whole reaction of Sergio Roberto throwing that ball so quickly, the goalkeeper was kind of caught off guard a little bit.
Yeah, and that's one thing I generally noticed, not just in this play, but they were really, Barcelona was really maintaining a good tempo. They were, it looked like days of old, you know, no dilly-dallying on free kicks. Like the first goal came when Arthur was on the ball. He got fouled, got called for a free kick, but he just, you know, stopped the ball with his hand, got it going again. Next thing you know, 12 seconds later, we have a goal. And there was a lot of that, a lot of just keeping the game going, keeping the ball moving, not letting up. So I think that we just had much more pace in in how we were managing the game as well. And I thought that was a really big asset.
That's a good observation because, you know, with that kind of tempo, you're just kind of, maybe you consider that part of being fresh, you know, having the week off, you know, and that type of thing. You're just more up for it. But like you said, you know, the tempo for the whole game, especially after we scored the first goal, there was a little bit of a malaise, maybe for like 5 minutes, as always, as we love to do.
Right.
We love to invite that. But after that, we were always, it was the two things. We had the lead and we figured out the press. And we were just kind of going with that tempo and always trying to do the counter. I mean, we had so many opportunities when it was 3-on-3. And, you know, the Eibar defense, it's so difficult to not only keep a high press, but also when Barcelona has that tempo, it just wears on you by the 60th, 70th minute. And we saw that kind of just open up the scoring opportunities. And especially when you bring in Dembele, it's just like another nightmare, you know?
Right, yeah. You know, there was a moment, it was in the second half, I don't know exactly what minute, but there was a moment where you had the front line, Coutinho, Messi, and Suarez, up against essentially five defenders. And it really, for a moment, I really thought they were going to score. And I thought, man, how cool would that be if these three guys could take out five defenders plus a goalkeeper? Like, I was waiting for it, and it looked possible. But on the other hand, you know, numbers are numbers. it's hard to make that happen.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't put it past them, you know, if you gave them five opportunities, I bet you they scored two times in training or something against five people. But
yeah,
like you said, I mean, I really wanted to see Coutinho get a goal. I think that would have really helped his confidence even more going forward, you know, because he did play well. But like you said, I mean, I'm happy with the result because especially since Atletico won earlier today, they've continued to put pressure on us. And, you know, it's this type of game that, you know, at the beginning, you know, it was a little bit touch and go, but we were able to not only get the points, but like you said, we had good tempo. We looked fresh and, you know, the second half, we had a lot of scoring opportunities and we just looked like we were actually wanted to play football on a Sunday night.
Yeah, exactly. So we're staying on top of the table at 43 points. Atletico's behind by five. And next up, we've got the return leg against Levante in the Copa del Rey on Thursday. And then Leganes is going to be in La Liga next week. Both will be at the Camp Nou. Now, next week, we're going to do something a little different, a little off book, because I will be in San Francisco having my wedding ceremony pretty much at the same time as the Leganes match is happening. And of course, during the weekend, I'll be doing other things preparing for that. So we're going to next week cover the Levante match. So we'll be covering Copa del Rey. We will have contributions from Michelle Taylor. So you'll be up to date on Barca Women. We'll cover whatever news we could by, let's say, Thursday or so. But we will not have a match review for Leganes because I will not be available. So let's get a win against Levante. Let's keep moving forward in the Copa del Rey. And we'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks to Michelle Taylor and Max Bleuer this week. This has been a production of Barca Talk, written by Gabriel Quiroga and Brian Henderson, editing and music by Brian Henderson, social media and promotion by Gabriel Quiroga. We can't make this show without you, the listeners, so go to barcatalk.net/support to see the premiums you get with a monthly contribution of support. And visca Barca!
Social Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.